Side 4. Chapter 7. Shady Tree. The customs officer, a paunchy, good-living man with dark sweat marks at the armpits of his grey uniform shirt, sauntered lazily over from the supervisor's desk to where Bond stood, his three pieces of luggage in front of him, under the letter B. Next door, under C, the girl took a packet of Parliaments out of her bag and put a cigarette between her lips. Bond heard several impatient clicks of the lighter, and the sharper snap as she put the lighter back in her bag and closed the fastening. Bond felt aware of her watchfulness. He wished that her name began with Z so that she would not be so close. Zarathustra, Zacharias, Zophany.
Mr. Bond?
Yes.
Is this your signature?
Yes.
Just your personal effects?
Yes, that's all. Okay, Mr. Bond. The man tore a customs stamp out of his book and pasted it on the suitcase. He did the same for the attaché case. He came to the golf clubs. He paused with a stamp book in his hand. He looked up at Bond.
What do you shoot, Mr. Bond?
Bond had a moment of blackout.
The golf clubs.
Sure, said the man patiently.
But what do you shoot? What do you go round in?
Bond could have kicked himself for forgetting the Americanism.
Oh, the middle 80s, I guess. Never broken 100 in my life, said the customs officer.
He gummed a blessed stamp on the side of the bag a few inches away from the richest haul of contraband that had ever been missed at Idlewild.
Have a good vacation, Mr. Bond.
Thanks, said Bond. He beckoned a porter and followed his bags across to the last hurdle, the inspector at the door. There was no pause. The man bent over, searched for the stamps, overstamped them, and waved him through.
Mr. Bond?
It was a tall, hatchet-faced man with mud-coloured hair and mean eyes. He was wearing dark brown slacks and a coffee-coloured shirt.
I have a car for you.
As he turned and led the way out into the hot, early morning sun, Bond noticed a square bulge in his hip pocket. It was about the shape of a small-caliber automatic. Typical, thought Bond. Mike Hammer routine. These American gangsters were too obvious. They'd read too many horror comics and seen too many films. The car was a black Oldsmobile sedan. Bond didn't wait to be told. He climbed into the front seat, leaving the disposal of his luggage in the back and the tipping of the porter to the man in brown. When they had left the cheerless prairie of Idlewild and had merged into the stream of commuter traffic on the Van Wyck Parkway, he felt he ought to say something.
How's the weather been over here?
The driver didn't take his eyes off the road.
Either side of 100.
That's pretty hot, said Bond. We haven't had it much over 75 in London.
That's so.
What's the program now? Asked Bond, after a pause. The man glanced in his driving mirror and pulled into the center lane. For a quarter of a mile, he busied himself with passing a bunch of slow-moving cars on the inside lanes. They came to an empty stretch of road. Bond repeated his question.
I said, what's the program?
The driver gave him a quick glance.
Shady wants you.
Does he? Said Bond. He was suddenly impatient with these people. He wondered how soon he would be able to throw some weight about. The prospect didn't look good. His job was to stay in the pipeline and follow it further. Any sign of independence or non-cooperation and he would be discarded. He would have to make himself small and stay that way. He would just have to get used to the idea. They swept into uptown Manhattan and followed the river as far as the 40s. Then they cut across town and pulled up halfway down West 46th Street, the Hatton Garden of New York. The driver double-parked outside an inconspicuous doorway. Their destination was sandwiched between a grubby-looking shop selling costume jewelry and an elegant shopfront faced with black marble. The silver italic lettering above the black marble entrance of the elegant shopfront was so discreet that if the name had not been in the back of Bond's mind, he would not have been able to decipher it from where he sat. It said, The House of Diamonds, Inc. As the car stopped, a man stepped off the pavement and sauntered round the car.
Everything okay? He said to the driver.
Sure. Boss in?
Yeah.
Want me to park the heap?
Be glad if you would.
The driver turned to Bond.
This is it, bud. Let's get the bags out.
Bond got out and opened the rear door. He picked up his small attaché case and reached for the golf clubs. I'll take the sticks, said the driver behind him. Obediently, Bond hauled out his suitcase. The driver reached in for the clubs and slammed the door of the car. The other man was already in the driver's seat, and the car moved off into the traffic as Bond followed the driver across the sidewalk and through the inconspicuous door. There was a man in a porter's lodge in the small hallway. As they came in, he looked up from the sports section of the news. "Hi," he said to the driver. He looked sharply at Bond.
"Hi,"
said the driver. "Mind if we leave the bags with you?"
"Go ahead," said the man. "Be okay in here."
He jerked his head back. The driver, with Bond's clubs over his shoulder, waited for Bond beside the doors of an elevator across the hall. When Bond followed him inside, he pressed the button for the fourth floor, and they rode up in silence. They emerged into another small hallway. It contained two chairs, a table, a large brass spittoon, and a smell of stale heat. They crossed the frayed carpet to a glass-fronted door, and the driver knocked and walked through without waiting for an answer. Bond followed him and shut the door. A man with very bright red hair and a big, peaceful, moon-shaped face was sitting at a desk. There was a glass of milk in front of him. He stood up as they came in, and Bond saw he was a hunchback. Bond didn't remember having seen a red-haired hunchback before. He could imagine that the combination would be useful for frightening the small fry who worked for the gang. The hunchback moved slowly around the desk and over to where Bond was standing. He walked round Bond, making a show of examining him minutely from head to foot, and then he came and stood close in front of Bond and looked up into his face. Bond looked impassively back into a pair of china eyes that were so empty and motionless that they might have been hired from a taxidermist. Bond had the feeling that he was being subjected to some sort of test. Casually, he looked back at the hunchback, noting the big ears with rather exaggerated lobes, the dry red lips of the big, half-open mouth, the almost complete absence of a neck, and the short, powerful arms in the expensive yellow silk shirt, cut to make room for the barrel-like chest and its sharp hump. "I like to have a look at the people we employ, Mr. Bond." The voice was sharp and pitched high. Bond smiled politely. "London tells me you have killed a man. I believe them. I can see you are capable of it. Would you like to do more work for us?"
"It depends what it is," said Bond. "Or rather," he hoped he was not being too theatrical, "how much you pay."
The hunchback gave a short squeal of laughter. He turned abruptly to the driver.
"Rocky, get those balls out of the bag and cut them open. Here."
He gave a quick shake of his right arm and held his open hand out to the driver. On it lay a double-bladed knife with a flat handle bound with adhesive tape. Bond recognized it as a throwing knife. He had to admit that the bit of legerdemain had been neatly executed.
"Yes, Bath," said the driver,
and Bond noticed the alacrity with which he took the knife and knelt on the floor to unstrap the ball pocket of the golf bag. The hunchback walked away from Bond and back to his chair. He sat down and picked up the glass of milk. He looked at it with distaste and swallowed the contents in two huge gulps. He looked at Bond as if for comment.
"Ulcers?" asked Bond sympathetically. "Who spoke to you?" said the hunchback angrily.
His anger was transferred to the driver.
"What you waiting for, Rocky? Put those balls on the table where I can see what you're doing. The number on the ball is the center of the plug. Dig 'em out."
"Coming, boss," said the driver. He stood up from the floor and put the six new balls on the desk. Five of them were still in their black wrapping. He took the sixth and turned it round in his fingers. Then he picked up the knife and dug its point into the cover of the ball and levered. A half-inch circular section of the ball came away on the tip of the blade, and he passed the ball across the desk to the hunchback, who tipped the contents, three uncut stones of 10 to 15 carats, onto the leather surface of the desk. The hunchback moodily poked the stones with his finger. The driver went on with his work until Bond counted 18 stones on the table. They were unimpressive in their rough state, but if they were of top quality, Bond could easily believe they might be worth £100,000 after cutting.
"Okay, Rocky," said the hunchback. 18, that's a lot. Now get those goddamn golf sticks out of here and send the boy to the Astor with him and this guy's bags. He's registered there. Have them sent up to his room, okay?"
"Okay, boss." The driver left the knife and the empty golf balls on the table, strapped up the ball pocket on Bond's bag, hoisted the bag on his shoulder, and left the room. Bond went over to a chair against the wall, pulled it over to face the hunchback across the desk, and sat down. He took a cigarette and lit it. He looked across at the hunchback and said, "And now, if you're happy, I'd be glad of those $5,000. The hunchback, who had been carefully watching Bond's movements, lowered his eyes to the untidy pile of diamonds in front of him. He poked them into a circle. Then he looked up at Bond.
"You will be paid in full, Mr. Bond." The high voice was precise and businesslike. "And you may get more than $5,000. But the method of payment will be devised as much for your protection as for ours. There will be no direct payment. And you'll understand why, Mr. Bond, because you will have made payoffs during your career of burglary. It is very dangerous for a man suddenly to be flush with money. He talks about it. He throws it around. And if the cops catch up with him and ask him where it all came from, he hasn't got an answer. Agree?"
"Yes," said Bond, surprised by the sanity and authority of what the man was saying. "That makes sense."
"So," said the hunchback, "I and my friends pay only very seldom and in small amounts for services rendered. Instead, we arrange for the guy to make the money on his own account. Take yourself. How much money have you got in your pocket?"
"About £3 and some silver," said Bond.
"All right," said the hunchback. "Today, you met your friend, Mr. Three." He pointed a finger at his chest, "which is me, a perfectly respectable citizen whom you knew in England in 1945 when he was concerned with the disposal of army surplus goods, remember?"
"Yes."
"I owed you $500 for a bridge game we had at the Savoy, remember?"
Bond nodded.
"When we meet today, I toss you double or quits for it, and you win, okay? So you now have $1,000, and I, a tax-paying citizen, will support your story. Here's the money."
The hunchback took a wallet out of his hip pocket and pushed 10 $100 bills across the table. Bond picked them up and put them casually in the pocket of his coat.
"And then," continued the hunchback, "you say you'd like to see some horse racing while you're over here. So I say to you, why not go and take a look at Saratoga? The meeting begins on Monday, and you say, okay, and you go up to Saratoga with your $1,000 in your pocket, okay?"
"Fine," said Bond.
"And you back a horse there. And it pays off at least fives, so you have your $5,000, and if anyone asks where it came from, you earned it, and you can prove it."
"What if the horse loses?"
"It won't."
Bond made no comment. So he was getting somewhere already, into the gangster world with a bang, the racing end of it. He looked across into the pale china eyes. It was impossible to tell whether they were receptive. They stared blankly back at him. "But now for the big step through the cutout." "Well, that's fine," said Bond, hoping that flattery was the key. "You people certainly seem to think things out. I like working for careful people." There was no encouragement in the china eyes. "I'd like to stay away from England for a bit. I suppose you couldn't do with an extra hand." The china eyes shifted away from his and inched reflectively over Bond's face and shoulders as if the hunchback was judging horse flesh. Then the man looked down at the circle of diamonds in front of him and carefully, thoughtfully, poked it into a square. There was silence in the room. Bond looked at his fingernails. At last, the hunchback looked up at him again.
"Could be," he said thoughtfully. "Could be there'd be something else for you. You made no mistake so far. You go on that way and keep your nose clean. Call me up after the race and I'll tell you what the word is. But like I said, just take it easy. Do what you're told, okay?"
Bond's muscles relaxed. He shrugged his shoulders. "Why should I get out of line? I'm looking for a job. And you can tell your outfit that I'm not particular so long as the pay's good." For the first time, the china eyes showed emotion. They looked hurt and angry, and Bond wondered if he had overplayed.
"Who do you think we are?"
The hunchback's voice rose to an indignant squeak.
"Some sort of a cheap crook outfit? Well, hell,"
he shrugged his shoulders resignedly. "Can't expect a limey to understand the way things are over here these days." The eyes went dull again. "Now listen to what I say. This is my number. Put it down. Wisconsin 73697. And write this down, too. But keep it yourself, or you may get your tongue cut out." Shady Tree's short, shrill laugh was not merry.
"Fourth race on Tuesday. The perpetuity stakes. 1.25 miles for 3-year-olds. And put your money on just before the windows close. You'll shift the odds with that grand of yours, okay?"
"Okay," said Bond, a pencil poised obediently over his notebook.
"Right," said the hunchback. "Shy smile. Big horse with a blaze face and 4 white stockings. And plan to win."
Chapter 8. The Eye That Never Sleeps. It was 12:30 when Bond went down in the elevator and out onto the roasting street. He turned right and walked slowly down towards Times Square. As he passed the handsome black marble frontage of the House of Diamonds, he stopped to examine the two discreet shop windows lined with dark blue velvet. In the center of each, there was just one piece of jewelry, an earring consisting of a big pear-shaped diamond hanging from another perfect stone, circular and brilliant cut. Below each earring, there was a thin plate of yellow gold in the shape of a visiting card with one edge turned down. On each plate was engraved the words, "Diamonds are forever." Bond smiled to himself. He wondered which of his predecessors had smuggled those four diamonds into America. Bond sauntered on in search of an air-conditioned bar where he could get out of the heat and do some thinking. He was pleased with his interview. At least it hadn't been the brush-off he had more than half expected. He was amused by the hunchback. There was something splendidly theatrical about him, and his vanity about the spangled mob was appealing. But he wasn't at all funny. Bond had walked for only a few minutes when it suddenly occurred to him that he was being followed. There was no evidence for it except a slight tingling of the scalp and an extra awareness of the people near him, but he had faith in his sixth sense, and he had once stopped in front of the shop window he was passing and looked casually back along 46th Street. Nothing but a lot of miscellaneous people moving slowly on the sidewalks, mostly on the same side as himself, the side that was sheltered from the sun. There was no sudden movement into a doorway, nobody casually wiping his face with a handkerchief to avert recognition, nobody bending down to tie a shoelace. Bond examined the Swiss watches in his shop window and then turned and sauntered on. After a few yards, he stopped again. Still nothing. He went on and turned right into the Avenue of the Americas, stopping in the first doorway, the entrance to a woman's underwear store, where a man in a tan suit with his back to him was examining the black lace pants on a particularly realistic dummy. Bond turned and leant against a pillar and gazed lazily but watchfully out into the street. And then something gripped his pistol arm, and a voice snarled, "All right, Lammy, take it easy unless you want lead for lunch." And he felt something press into his back, just above the kidneys. What was the familiar about that voice? The law? The gang? Bond glanced down to see what was holding his right arm. It was a steel hook. Well, if the man had only one arm! Like lightning, he swiveled, bending sideways and bringing his left fist round in a flailing blow, low down. There was a smack as his fist was caught in the other man's left hand, and at the same time as the contact telegraphed to Bond's mind that there could have been no gun, there came the well-remembered laugh and the lazy voice saying, "No good, James. The angels have got you." Bond straightened himself slowly, and for a moment he could only gaze into the grinning, hawk-like face of Felix Leiter with blank disbelief, his built-up tension slowly relaxing. "So, you're doing a front tail, you lousy bastard," he finally said. He looked with delight at the friend he had last seen as a cocoon of dirty bandages on a blood-stained bed in a Florida hotel, the American secret agent with whom he had shared so many adventures. "What the hell are you doing here? And what the hell do you mean playing the bloody fool in this heat?" Bond took out a handkerchief and wiped it over his face. "For a moment, you almost made me nervous." "Nervous?" Felix Leiter laughed scornfully. "You were saying your prayers, and your conscience is so bad you didn't even know if you were going to get it from the cops or the gang, right?" Bond laughed and dodged the question. "Come on, you crooked spy," he said. "You can buy me a drink and tell me all about it. I just don't believe in odds as long as this. In fact, you can buy me lunch. You Texans are lousy with money." "Sure," said Leiter. He slipped his steel hook into the right-hand pocket of his coat and took Bond's arm with his left hand. They moved out onto the street, and Bond noticed that Leiter walked with a heavy limp. "In Texas, even the fleas are so rich they can hire themselves dogs. Let's go. Sardi's is just over the way." Leiter avoided the fashionable room at the famous actors and writers eating house and led Bond upstairs. His limp was more noticeable, and he held on to the banisters. Bond made no comment, but when he left his friend at a corner table in the blessedly air-conditioned restaurant and went off to the washroom to clean himself up, he added up his impressions. The right arm had gone, and the left leg, and there were imperceptible scars below the hairline above the right eye that suggested a good deal of grafting, but otherwise Leiter looked in good shape. The grey eyes were undefeated. The shock of straw-coloured hair had no hint of grey in it, and there was none of the bitterness of a cripple in Leiter's face. But in their short walk there had been a hint of reticence in Leiter's manner, and Bond felt this had something to do with him, Bond, and perhaps with Leiter's present activities. Certainly not, he thought, as he walked across the room to join his friend, with Leiter's injuries. There was a medium-dry martini with a piece of lemon peel waiting for him. Bond smiled at Leiter's memory and tasted it. It was excellent, but he didn't recognize the vermouth. "Made with Crest Blanca," explained Leiter. "New domestic brand from California. Like it?" "Best vermouth I ever tasted." "And I've taken a chance and ordered you smoked salmon and Brazola," said Leiter. "We got some of the finest meat in America here, and Brazola's the best cut of that. Beef, straight cut across the bone, roast and then broiled. Suit you?"
"Anything you say," said Bond. "We've eaten enough meals together to know each other's tastes."
"I told them not to hurry," said Leiter. He rapped on the table with his hook.
"We'll have another martini first, and while you drink it, you'd better come clean."
There was warmth in his smile, but his eyes were watching Bond. "Just tell me one thing. What business have you got with my old friend Shady Tree?" He gave his order to the waiter and sat forward in his chair and waited. Bond finished his first martini and lit a cigarette. He swiveled casually in his chair. The tables near them were empty. He turned back and faced the American. "You tell me something first, Felix," he said softly. "Who are you working for these days? Still the CIA?"
"Nix," said Leiter. "With my gun hand gone, they could only offer me desk work. Very nice about it, and paid me off handsomely when I said I wanted an open-air life. So Pinkerton's made me a good offer. You know, the eye that never sleeps, people. So now I'm just a door-basher, private detective. Put on some clothes and open up routine, but it's good fun. They're a nice crowd to work with, and one day I'll be able to retire with a pension and a presentation gold watch that goes green in summer. As a matter of fact, I'm in charge of their race gang squad. Doping, crooked running, night guards at the stables, all that sort of thing. Good job, and it takes you all over the country."
"Sounds all right," said Bond. "But I didn't know you knew anything about horses."
"You shouldn't be able to recognize a horse unless there's a milk wagon tied on behind," admitted Leiter. "But you soon pick it up, and it's mostly the people you have to know about, not the horses. What about you?" He lowered his voice. "Still with the old firm?"
"That's right," said Bond.
"On a job for them now?"
"Yes."
"Undercover?"
"Yes." Leiter sighed. He sipped his martini reflectively.
"Well," he said finally, "you're a damn fool to be operating alone if it's anything to do with the Spangled Boys. In fact, you're such a bad risk, I'm crazy even to be having lunch with you. But I'll tell you why I was gumshoeing around Shady's neck of the woods this morning. Maybe we can help each other. Without involving our outfits, of course. Okay?"
"You know I'd like to work with you, Felix," said Bond seriously. "But I'm still working for the government, while you're probably in competition with yours. But if it turns out our target's the same, there's no sense in getting wires crossed. If we're chasing the same hare, I'll be happy to run with you."
"Now," Bond looked quizzically at the Texan, "am I right in thinking you're interested in someone with a blaze face and four white stockings?" Called Shy Smile.
"That's right," said Leiter, not particularly surprised. "Running at Saratoga on Tuesday. And what might the running of this horse have to do with the security of the British Empire?"
"I've been told to back him," said Bond. $1,000 to win. Payoff for another job."
Bond lifted up his cigarette and his hand covered his mouth. "I brought £100,000 worth of uncut diamonds in by plane this morning for Mr. Spang and his friends." Leiter's eyes narrowed. He gave a low whistle of surprise.
"Boy," he said respectfully, "you're certainly in a bigger league than me. I'm only interested because Shy Smile is a ringer. The horse that's due to win on Tuesday won't be Shy Smile at all. Shy Smile wasn't even placed the last three times he ran, and anyway, they've shot him. It'll be a very fast job called Pick a Pepper. Just by chance, he's got a blaze face and four white stockings, too. Big chestnut, and they've done a good job with his hooves and various other small points of difference. They've been getting this job ready for over a year, out in the desert in Nevada, where the Spangs have got some sort of a ranch. And are they going to clean up? It's a big race, with $25,000 added, and you can bet they'll plaster the country with their money just before the off. K?" can't fail to do better than fives, more like 10 or 15 to 1. They'll make a packet.
But I thought all horses in America have to have their lips tattooed, said Bond. How have they got round that?
Grafting new skin onto Pickapepper's mouth. Copied Shy Smile's marks on it. This tattoo gimmick is getting old-fashioned. The word in Pinkerton's is that the Jockey Club are going to change to photos of the night eyes.
What are night eyes?
They're those calluses on the inside of a horse's knees. The English call them chestnuts. Seems they're different on every horse, like a man's fingerprints. But it'll be the same old story. They'll photo the night eyes on every racehorse in America and then find the gangs have dreamed up a way of altering them with acid. The cops never catch up to the robbers.
How do you know all this about Shy Smile?
Blackmail, said Lodger cheerfully. I had a drugging rap all lined up in one of the Spang stable bars. I let him buy his way out of it with the details of this little caper.
What are you going to do about it?
Remains to be seen. Gone up to Saratoga on Sunday. Lodger's face lit up.
Hell, why don't you come along with me? Driving up, and I'll get you in at my dump. Sagamore, Swanky Motel. You gotta sleep somewhere. Better not be seen out together much, but we'll be able to meet up in the evenings. What'd you say?
Wonderful, said Bond. Couldn't be better.
And now it's damn near 2 o'clock.
Let's have some lunch, and I'll tell you my end of the story.
The smoked salmon was from Nova Scotia, and a poor substitute for the product of Scotland. But the Brazola was all that Lighter had said, so tender that Bond could cut it with a fork. He finished his lunch with half an avocado with French dressing and then dawdled over his espresso.
And that's the long and short of it, Bond concluded the story he had been telling between mouthfuls. And my guess is that the Spangs are doing the smuggling and the House of Diamonds, which they own, is doing the merchandising. Any views?
Lighter tapped a lucky strike out onto the table with his left hand and lit it at the flame of Bond's ronson.
Sounds possible, he agreed after a pause. But I don't know much about this brother of Serafino, Jack Spang. And if Jack Spang is, say, it's the first I've heard of him for a long while. We've got records and all the rest of the mob, and I've come across Tiffany Case. Nice kid, but she's been on the fringe of the gangs for years and didn't have much chance from the cradle up. Her mother ran the snazziest cat house in San Francisco, doing fine until she made one hell of a mistake, decided one day not to pay the local outfit's protection money. She was paying the police so much, I guess she reckoned they'd look after her. Crazy. One night the mob turned up in force and wrecked the joint. Left the girls alone, but had themselves a gang-bang with Tiffany. She was only 16 at the time. Not surprising she won't have anything to do with men since then. Next day she got hold of her mother's cash box, busted it open, and took to the hills. Then the usual round, hat-check girl, taxi dancer, studio extra, waitress, until she was about 20. Then maybe life didn't seem so good, and she took to liquor. Settled in a rooming house down in one of the Florida Keys and started drinking herself to death. Got so she was known as the Boiled Sweet down there. Then a kid fell in the sea, and she jumped in and saved him. Got her name in the papers, and some rich woman took a fancy to her and practically kidnapped her. Made her join Alcoholics Anonymous, and then took her around the world as her companion. But Tiffany skipped when they got to Frisco and went and lived with her old ma, retired from the girl game by then. But she'd never settled down. I guess she found life a bit quiet, so she went on the lam again and ended up in Reno. Worked at Harold's Club for a bit. Came across our friend Serafimo, and he got all excited because she wouldn't sleep with him. Offered her some sort of a job at the Tiara in Las Vegas, and she's been there for the last year or two, doing these trips to Europe in between, I suppose. But she's a good kid. Just never had a chance after what the gang did to her.
Bond saw again the eyes gazing sullenly at him out of the mirror, and he heard the record playing Feuille Morte in the lonely room.
I like her, he said briefly.
He felt Felix Leiter's eyes watching him speculatively. He looked at his watch.
Well, Felix, he said, it looks as if we've got hold of the same tiger, but by different tails. It's going to be fun pulling at them both at the same time. Now, I'm going to go and get some sleep. Got a room at the Astor. Where shall we meet on Sunday?
Better keep away from this part of town, said Leiter. Meet you outside the plaza, early, so we can avoid the traffic on the parkway. Let's say 9 o'clock, by the cab stand, you know, where the horse cabs are. Then if I'm late, you can get to recognize a horse. Useful up at Saratoga.
He paid the check, and they walked down and out onto the grinning street. Bond hailed a cab.
Leiter refused a lift. Instead, he took Bond affectionately by the arm.
Just one thing, James, he said. and his voice was serious. You may not think the hell of a lot of American gangsters, compared with Smursh, for instance, and some of the other folk you've been up against. But I can tell you these Spangled boys are the tops. They've got a good machine, even if they do care to have funny names. And they've got protection. That's how it is in America these days. But don't misunderstand me. They really stink. And this job of yours stinks, too. Lighter let go of Bond's arm and watched him climb into the taxi. Then he leant in through the window. And do you know what your job stinks of, you dumb bastard? He asked cheerfully. Formaldehyde and lilies. End of side 4.